What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Richard Michelson, author of the new book, What Louis Brandeis Knows, A Crusader for Social Justice Becomes a Supreme Court Justice. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. You know, it's easy as a contemporary Jewish commentator and radio show and podcast host to spend all your time talking about Israel and anti-Semitism. The last couple of years have given us all the news about Israel we could possibly manage, and the rising tide of anti-Semitism worldwide has become a kind of pandemic of its own. And we here on Too Jewish have, for over 2 years now, found ourselves immersed in both of these subjects. In fact, in the last 24 months, 25 months maybe, if you just restrict yourself to listening to Jewish podcasts, reading Jewish newspapers and websites, reading all the Jewish-themed mail you receive, streaming the speeches, YouTube channels, TikToks, and other Jewish videos, you would certainly think that there is simply nothing else valuable about Judaism but anti-Semitism in Israel. Well, I'm here today to tell you that that is not all there is to Judaism, of course, not by any means. Yes, Israel is extremely important. Yes, anti-Semitism is wrong and a rising problem nearly everywhere. But when we reduce our 3,800-year-old tradition to two causes, important causes to be certain, but still, when we reduce to two single elements are 3,800 years of tradition, ethics, morality, belief, ritual, art, music, poetry, mysticism, prayer, intellectual brilliance, philosophy, law, holiness, history, and so much more. Well, then we are doing ourselves a profound disservice, because Judaism is amazing. Now, it's partly because we Jews have been around for four millennia or so and have lived and had active Jewish communities in essentially every country on the planet at one time or another, and most of them for long periods of time. That diversity is an incredible strength expressed in Jewish prayer, thought, music, food, art, clothing, even temperament. There's something amazing exploring the incredible range of Jewish life across the world, visiting different Jewish communities, learning and sharing music and customs. In the incredible variety of experience, there is tremendous richness indeed. And the same can be said about the fantastic storehouse of Jewish learning and lore, the extensive library we have created of wisdom, inspiration, and exploration of meaning that includes some of the greatest works of human creativity ever made. You know, I've been studying and teaching Judaism for a really long time now, and yet, in some ways, I feel I've only just scratched the surface of what's available. Of course, you don't need to be a rabbi or a scholar to gain from studying Judaism and Jewish texts. You simply have to have an open mind and an interest in making your own life better. I must also note that the remarkable range of learning and experience that the opportunities of living a Jewish life makes available, well, it's balanced by powerful, shared, and interesting elements of identity and character. For Jews, no matter how divergent our backgrounds, and they are diverse, we share many common values: a deep dedication to family, reverence for the importance of education, learning, a profound connection to the land of Israel, of course, a vital commitment, however, to the greater notion of Klal Yisrael, the great shared peoplehood of Jews everywhere. We are all deeply committed to the greatest of Jewish ideals, the concept of justice, preserving it, seeking justice in our world. We give tzedakah, the charity that goes towards righting the wrongs that we perceive. We all work to help the downtrodden and the needy in our civilization. All of which is to say that it is appropriate to care about Israel and to fight anti-Semitism, but it is also incumbent upon us as contemporary Jews to actualize our Judaism in some of the other and amazingly varied and incredibly positive ways that are always available to us every day. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's Josh Warshawski and Colleen Dierker's interpretation of the prayer of God's love for us from the morning service, an expression of that desire for learning about goodness and justice. Ahava Rabbah.
Ahava Rabbah.
That was a contemporary interpretation of the morning prayer, Ahava Rabbah. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be our good friend, Richard Michelson, author of a new children's book on the great Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. Hear his story when he joins us in a moment on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, our good friend Richard Michelson, who has another book out. It's called What Louis Brandeis Knows, A Crusader for Social Justice Becomes a Supreme Court Justice. Richard is a gallery owner, an author, man of letters, talent. What's the best description for you?
I'm just a regular guy. How's that?
I like that. I like that very much. Tell us where the idea for the book about Louis Brandeis came from.
Well, first of all, it's an absolute pleasure to be back on your show. It's been wonderful for me to be able to share over the years my various books with your audience and with you. So thank you. This book had an odd beginning. It actually started about 6 years ago, before the pandemic, when I got a call from Brandeis University Press, and they were thinking of starting an illustrated line of books, and they asked if I had anything I was interested in that might kick off their program. And I said, well, you're Brandeis University. How about a biography of Louis Brandeis?
The brilliant origin story here.
They said, oh, that sounds like a great idea. So I started researching Brandeis's life and reading everything I can about him, his various law decisions, his letters, etc. the sort of thing that this is that don't show up in the book per se, but I have to read everything he's written just to put myself in his frame of mind. So when I'm writing about him, I know kind of what he's thinking. As it turned out, Brandeis, COVID started, and Brandeis decided the time was not right for them to do to start a new program of books. Everybody was nervous back then. They told me that feel free to sell it elsewhere. I sent it out and sold it in about a week. There was a lot of interest. So I had at that point read so much, I was amazed. I was amazed that, especially in this day and age, that he's not part of the daily conversation, especially with what's going on in the Supreme Court today. I don't want to get overly political here, but it's hard to write a book like this and not.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he was so prescient in his decisions, and so much what he wrote, he figured what we're going through now. So, you know, it was just amazing to me.
We will explore the life of Louis Brandeis, which is extraordinary, his accomplishments, and why it's absolutely relevant today when we come back in a few moments with Richard Michelson here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established 7 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services, or if you can't come in person, come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going great guns for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come Friday night, 6:30 p.m. Shabbat evening celebration services, always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m., services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can also come to services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our services are in person and virtually, and all of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. You can find out about them at our website, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail. or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments all help. We are now pleased and serene to welcome back a recurring feature of Too Jewish, Zen Judaism's Contemplate the perfect sphere, round, whole, complete, your own mother's matzah ball. Ah, yes, that was a koan of Zen Judaism. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So in addition to being an expert on every aspect of the Jewish world around the world nearly, you've also taught classes on the history of Islam. And I think you know as much about it as nearly anybody I know. I want to try to explore the differences in the Islamic world that I think a lot of Americans simply don't know much about, even the very wise listeners of Too Jewish. Tell us a little bit about the Sunni-Shia divide, where it comes from, and maybe a little bit about how it manifests in some of the politics, not only of the Middle East, but of the whole world.
Sure. I must confess to having forgotten some of the detail. It's, you know, a long time since I taught this stuff.
Right.
But the basics are pretty clear. In the earliest years of Islam, you know, the middle of the 7th century, all Muslims were Sunni. There was no distinction. And Sunni referred to the Sunnah, which were the earliest commentaries on the Quran. Like, sort of, Mishnah was earlier than Gemara. Gemara is basically a commentary on the Mishnah, right?
Right.
So the Sunnah were the earliest commentaries directly on the holy text, supposedly revealed by Allah. Then, after and I don't even remember what the third or fourth caliph, there was like a great schism within Islam, because the schism occurred over the line of succession. Who would be either the fourth or the fifth caliph after the guy who died? And there were those who went for one guy who eventually became the universally recognized caliph. But there were other people who supported a direct descendant of Muhammad named Ali. And that group of people was called the Shi'at ul Ali, the party of Ali, or like the supporters of Ali. And they became known eventually as the Shia from Shi'at. And they believed in a different line of succession. So not only was it a different line of succession, but it was also different interpretations of the earliest law and the earliest commentaries on the law, which were the Sunnah collectively. So this fierce rivalry developed. It was like the great schism in the Catholic Church between Protestants and Catholics, but it was a schism between Shia and Sunni. And in earliest years, the geographic distinction was mostly that Iran was Shiite and Iraq and Turkey and points west were Sunni. And that's still basically true. There are minority Shiite sects in Turkey and throughout the Islamic world, but it's still basically an east-west divide between Shia, who are more, I don't even know the word, what we would say in Hebrew, mahmir.
Yeah, strict, almost rigorous, or I don't know, super observant, ultra-Orthodox.
Right. So in their interpretation of the law, they were more strict. They were more Beit Shammai than Beit Hillel. And the Sunni were a little bit more liberal and innovative and more Beit Hillel, more humanitarian and a little loosey-goosey. So that what you see today, for example, is in Turkey, a lot of people, even though they're practicing Muslims, drink beer or rakı. It's not something that gets to excommunicate, whereas in the Shiite countries, it would, as a concrete example.
The distinction is sometimes also ethnic, right? So, for example, Iran, as opposed to Saudi Arabia, right? There's a major Shia-Sunni split there. Is that a factor sort of in how it developed as well?
No, it's not ethnic. It's geographical. Iran is to the east. Iran was always Shiite territory. And Saudi Arabia is western. Huh. And it was always Sunni territory.
Okay. So it's really not about, you know, Persians as opposed to Arabs. It's just this is where the line is drawn.
Right.
Tom, thanks so much. It's very helpful. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
Time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe was the unremarkable new employee in an accounting firm. One afternoon, he went into his boss's office and declared, "Boss, I personally know everybody in the world." His boss obviously couldn't believe this ridiculous claim, and he challenged Moshe, "You know everybody in the world?" And Moshe said, "Yes, sir. Choose anyone. I'll prove it." His boss said, "I bet you don't know Taylor Swift." And Moshe said, "Oh, I email Taylor often. I've sent her song lyrics she uses. We're buddies." His boss was determined to expose Moshe's ruse. He immediately bought 2 plane tickets to Nashville. They went to Taylor Swift's house there. When they knocked, however, Taylor Swift personally opened the door, opened her arms and shouted, "Moshe, what a nice surprise. Come in, come in." And they both spent a lovely afternoon with her. Moshe's boss wasn't convinced. He said, "Okay, how about President Trump?" "Donald," said Moshe, "of course. We've been buddies for years. We talk on the phone." Moshe's boss almost lost his cool, decided he had to see this. Falsehood revealed immediately. So he flew Moshe to Washington with him. They took a cab immediately to the White House. They walked into a press conference where President Trump was making a speech. Trump happened to look in Moshe's direction. Moshe shouted, "Donald, Donald," and Trump with a smile shouted back, "Moshe, buddy, come on in, let's have a talk." Moshe's boss was bewildered. He couldn't believe it. But his mind didn't stop working. The chances that Moshe knew everybody on the planet were billions to one. He decided on a final test, the Pope. Moshe couldn't possibly know the Pope. But Moshe claimed, "Oh, I knew the Pope when I lived in Chicago." So his boss got international tickets. They flew to Rome and went immediately to the Vatican. There, in the middle of thousands and thousands of people, the Pope interrupted his prayer. They could see his lips saying, "Moshe," with a smile on his face. The Pope opened his arms and waved Moshe to come up to the balcony. Moshe quickly went up there with his boss, getting a blessing and a big hug from the Pope. Suddenly, Moshe's boss fainted. Moshe rushed to his boss's side, revived him, and Moshe asked him, "What's wrong?" His boss, sweating profusely, said, "Look, Moshe, I accept Taylor Swift. I accepted Trump. Even the Pope I've accepted. But I couldn't take it anymore when here in Rome, in the Vatican, in the middle of the crowd, somebody shouted, "Who's that guy with a red hat and white on the balcony, hugging Moshe?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. The story of the twins, Jacob and Esau, begins in utero. Rivals from before birth, wrestling in their mother Rebecca's womb, the red-haired outdoorsman Esau and his grasping, domestically inclined younger brother Jacob spend our Torah portion of Toldot vying for their father's and mother's love and attention. Each is partly successful and each partly fails. That sibling rivalry shaped the course of our people's early history, but it also teaches us something important about ourselves. First, a word about words. Toldot is rich in real-life details told in terrifically, even perfect writing. Rebecca, pregnant with the two boys wrestling inside her, tells God, "If it's like this, why am I alive?" Prefiguring the words nearly every pregnant mom thinks or says at some point. Esau is hairy and rough at birth. Jacob smooth, born holding fast to Esau's heel. Esau famished from a long hunt, trades his birthright for a bowl of stew, and ate, drank, stood up, left, and disdained. The series of active verbs delineating his turbulent, thoughtless character. Jacob, smooth-faced, smooth-talking lawyer that he is, audibly calculates the coming consequences of every action beforehand. Now, onto that little rivalry. The familial tension in Toldot is palpable throughout. In fact, there's source enough here to go around for everybody in this small family. Isaac, the father and the link between more important patriarchs, finds trouble everywhere but avoids it by simply moving on. Each time he finds more success and then more trouble and moves again. Rebecca sees the wayward ways of her eldest boy Esau and chooses to manipulate the situation in order to give the inheritance to Jacob, remaking the birth order retroactively. But the great struggle is between Jacob and Esau. I'm reminded of the 1960s TV stars, the Smothers Brothers' old line, "Mom liked you best." Mom certainly liked Jacob best, while Dad liked Esau best. That kind of favoritism never ends well, and in the short term, it certainly doesn't. At the end of our portion, Esau has been doubly defrauded, while Jacob is forced to flee the consequences of his own duplicity, running from the only home he's known without so much as a blanket to cover himself at night. In a sense, this conflicted family damages all of its members. Each is wounded, none left really whole. It's a drama similar to so many in our own lives. And yet, in a couple more Torah portions, we will see that each member of this now shattered nuclear family has played, or will play, a central role in furthering God's design for our world. In spite of their mistakes and injuries, each helps, ultimately, to carry out pivotal elements furthering God's mission, and that will create the great people of Israel. You know, in challenging times and in conflicted families, it's often hard to see that ultimately there is a divine plan or a place for each participant. But Toldot, which means generations, by the way, teaches us that in spite of what we might perceive in our own small field of vision, God continues to work in this world, and we may very well be furthering a greater plan. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Richard Michelson, tells us more about the extraordinary lawyer, advocate for social causes, Zionist leader Louis Brandeis, who became a Supreme Court legend. Find out all about him when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Hamas returned the remains of Hadar Golden, an Israeli soldier it murdered and kidnapped way back in 2014, to Israel last week, bringing the number of hostages whose remains the Palestinian terrorists still hold in Gaza to 4. The body of a hostage murdered by Islamic Jihad was released late last week, but as we go to air, we do not yet have confirmation of the identity. All 4 of the remaining bodies belonged to people who were murdered when Hamas Palestinian terrorists and other Palestinian terrorists attacked southern Israel October 7, 2023. That number has shrunk steadily in recent days as Hamas repatriated the remains of half a dozen hostages, including Itai Chen, the final American-Israeli held in Gaza. The repatriations came as Hamas faces steep pressure, including from U.S. President Donald Trump, to uphold its end of the ceasefire deal that ended fighting in Gaza last month. As part of the deal, Hamas terrorists agreed to return all living and dead hostages immediately. But while 20 living hostages were freed at one time last month, the terrorist group has located and released dead hostages' remains much more slowly, sometimes with snafus that have drawn allegations of ceasefire violations. Lieutenant Hadar Golden, an Israeli Defense Forces officer killed in Gaza in 2014, whose body was held there ghoulishly by the Hamas terrorists for more than a decade, finally was buried in a ceremony attended by tens of thousands, including the IDF chief of staff. The long-awaited funeral was a moment of closure and reckoning for Golden's relatives, and as noted in their eulogies for the country. For years, Golden's family was a lonely voice campaigning for the release of his body from Gaza, along with that of fellow fallen soldier Aaron Shaul. That cause was greatly amplified after the Hamas terrorist-led October 7, 2023 attack, when Golden was included among the more than 250 hostages whose return became a national Israeli mission. Still, Golden's family waited through 2 more painful years. Hundreds of hostages living and dead, including his fellow soldier Shaul, were finally returned to Israel, but still no guarantee or timetable for their son's return. Finally, last week, his body came back. He was the 5th to last hostage released after October 7th and the final casualty of the 2014 war to come home. Idan Amedi, the Israeli singing star who was badly wounded serving in Gaza in January 2024 and has recovered since, sang at Golden's funeral his song Nigmar, Finished. Idan Amedi had some harsh words for the current Israeli administration of Bibi Netanyahu and the failures surrounding Hamas's October 7th Palestinian terrorist attack on Israel, and for the objection of the prime minister's government to a state commission of inquiry that will investigate the onslaught, as well as for its decision to rename the war the War of Revival. October 7th wasn't a tragedy, it was a failure, Amedi said. We use the word tragedy for natural disasters, for fires. October 7th was a failure. It was willful blindness, despite all the warnings written on the wall. He continued, this is not a war of revival. Revival is a painful process for a person or a nation that recognizes trauma or crisis, acknowledges the fall or destruction, that doesn't sweep facts under the rug. This marked the 2nd funeral for Golden. Shortly after his death, the IDF rabbinate declared him deceased for purposes of Jewish burial and grief. His family held a funeral in Kfar Saba back then, attended by thousands, and sat Shiva, the 7-day Jewish mourning period. In other news of Palestinian terrorists last week, sources report 2 Palestinian terrorists were killed near the West Bank settlement of Karmeit Sur. The individuals were attempting to throw Molotov cocktails when they were shot. The IDF reports that soldiers operating near the community eliminated the 2 terrorists who were on their way to carry out a terror attack. And in Bethlehem, the Shin Bet Security Service, along with the IDF and police, announced that they thwarted a planned Hamas operation in the Bethlehem area, which was planning shooting attacks against security forces and civilians. According to the announcement, as part of the Shin Bet's investigation, approximately 40 Palestinian terrorists were arrested and weapons, including M16 rifles, were seized.
Finally, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said violence in the West Bank, which is surging, could undercut the fragile ceasefire in Gaza, which the U.S. is working to preserve. Certainly, there's some concern about events in the West Bank spilling over and creating an effect that would undermine what we're doing in Gaza, Rubio said. The comments are a stark confirmation that U.S. officials are paying attention with alarm to conditions in the West Bank, where Israeli settlers have increased their pace of attacks on Palestinians recently. Masked settlers attacked Palestinians in two villages last week, drawing an unusual rebuke from Israel's president, Isaac Herzog. The harsh events that took place in the Shomron by a handful of violent and dangerous individuals are shocking and serious, Herzog said. Such violence against civilians and against IDF soldiers crosses a red line. I condemn it severely, said the Israeli president. All state authorities must act decisively to eradicate the phenomenon and to strengthen the idea of fighters and security forces who protect us day and night. And last, Gal Gadot, Israeli supermodel and movie star of Wonder Woman, was named the winner of the Genesis Prize last week for supporting Israel, even as backlash against the country's actions in Gaza rocked Hollywood. Since October 7, 2023, Gadot has been an outspoken advocate for Israelis who were taken captive by Hamas terrorists and held hostage. Calling herself a proud Jew and a proud Israeli, she said she will dedicate the $1 million award to organizations that will help Israel heal. Recipients of the Genesis Prize, first awarded in 2014, usually donate it to charitable causes they choose, which have included advancing women's equality, racial and economic justice, and combating anti-Semitism and efforts to delegitimize the state of Israel. Stan Polovitz, the co-founder and CEO of the Genesis Prize Foundation, praised Gal Gadot's moral clarity about Israel. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Richard Michelson is, he says just a regular guy, but I think a talented author, owner of an important art gallery. He has written on a wide variety of subjects, and his new book is titled What Louis Brandeis Knows, A Crusader for Social Justice Becomes a Supreme Court Justice. So Brandeis was controversial for so many reasons as an appointment to the Supreme Court, not least of which he's the first Jewish appointment officially to the Supreme Court. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, it was the first divided confirmation that has become kind of standard today. But, you know, he was the youngest graduate of Harvard Law School with the highest grade in their history when he came out. And yet when he was, you know, brought up for appointment to the Supreme Court, the president of Harvard was at the time one of the people who were most against him. The anti-Semitism was, well, it was out there, filled with, you know, mostly dog whistles, but his dual loyalty to the United States was challenged. He was called a muckraker. He was called a radical. He was called a socialist. He was called a traitor to his country. And he had been the first lawyer to actually accuse the president at the time, Taft, of outwardly lying. And he was working with a whistleblower. Taft had said that he was going to save Alaskan wildlife, Alaskan lands for hunting, fishing, recreation. Meanwhile, he was selling that same land to oil developers and drillers. And Brandeis went to court to say that he was lying. At the time, that was unheard of. Lawyers, especially Jewish ones, did not accuse the president of lying. He was called ungentlemanly. This is not the way things were. But what happened was that the Justice Department at the time did not get the president's memo, that they were supposed to bury a memo that he had written. And it came to light that, in fact, there was his proof that he was lying and he was backroom dealing. Still, most of the elected officials turned against Brandeis, blamed him But the citizens, the people, he was called the people's attorney. And he had, over the years, helped so many average citizens, teachers, railroad workers. Everybody started writing letters to their elected officials. And in the end, they turned the tide. And he was appointed to the court. And, they turned the tide at the time. F had to renege on selling the drilling. But later, the same thing happened when he was brought up to the Supreme Court. And again, people came out in his favor. Brandeis would say that the most important political office in the country is that of private citizen, more important than the president. And at the time, the citizens backed him up.
Brandeis himself came from a secular Jewish family, but identified strongly as a Jew and became a proponent of Zionism, an important proponent of Zionism in America. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, as a child, he had a Christmas tree. But his uncle, Dembent, was where he sometimes spent his time. And his uncle was very religious and a lawyer. And Lewis idolized his uncle. He ended up changing his middle name from Lewis David to Lewis Dembitz Brandeis. But he still was very secular in his life. He himself did not follow Jewish routines. But at one point in his law career, he found himself, protecting, fighting for many recent Jewish immigrants from Russia and Eastern Europe who were striking for unionization. And he was impressed by them, frankly. He had a vision of, the Eastern European Jews versus the Western European Jews, at first looking down on them, as many immigrants did at the time that were from Western Europe. But he found that these people were hard workers, that they deserved to be, to be championed. And the more he got to know them and some important Zionists at the time, he ended up being swayed. He was very much wanted, fairness in society, in education. And the early pioneers of Zionists who were, setting up the society wanted what Brandeis wanted. He wanted equality. He wanted people to be working together. He decided that he would take on the mantle of leading the American Zionist movement. At the time, it was a very ragtag movement. Most Jews did not want to join because they were afraid of being attacked for double loyalty, for putting their history and their people above the United States. But when Brandeis signed on, suddenly that is what changed the movement in America, because he was idolized by so many Jews, and for him to take that on, and again, as many of his decisions, he turned out to be prescient. Israel was needed. I have to say that it did not, in the end, live up to his idyllic vision of it. He very much wanted equal rights for Arabs and Jews, and I think he would have been appalled at some of the way that Israel eventually moved. But he was very much pro-Zionist, and I think that he would have his problems today, but he turned out that we did need an Israel to go to.
He certainly would have some problems with the Supreme Court as it functions today. William O. Douglas, the famous liberal justice, wrote that Brandeis was dangerous not only because of his brilliance, because he was incorruptible. And the establishment was afraid of Brandeis because he insisted on social justice for everybody. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, he was incorruptible. I think one of the major things that would just astound him today, he was used to politicians and corporations lying and trying to take advantage of the people. He knew that. He was a realist. But I think one thing that he would not be able to get his head around is to see law firms today working pro bono for the president and for the government. The first lawyer who started working pro bono for the people At one point, he was out of debt. He had enough money, and he decided he would not turn away anyone who could not afford his fee, his law firm, taking on cases for free and arguing against the government generally and against corporations for the common people. He paid back his law firm for the hours he was working pro bono. And eventually, working pro bono became a basic thing for most law firms. And to see how it has been turned on its head, and instead of working for people who cannot afford a lawyer, it's now, you know, working for big corporations, for the government. I think that would have been hard for him to wrap his head around.
You know, it's a long time, more than a century since he was appointed to the Supreme Court. He served for more than 30 years after his controversial appointment. He kind of established the idea of the Jewish seats on the Supreme Court. You know, Cardozo then went on later, then Frankfurter after Cardozo passed away, and he had resigned. There was this idea, later was Arthur Goldberg, the idea was that there's going to be a Jewish seat on the Supreme Court. You know, there was a moment not too long ago when a third of the Supreme Court was Jewish, and almost more.
Yeah. And when Brandeis was appointed to the court, he was the first non-Christian appointee. And I have it in my book, in the end notes, I don't remember. But until that point, every appointee for the Supreme Court was basically coming from the same culture. So it was quite a shock to the system.
Brandeis's motivation to help those who couldn't afford legal counsel, his pro bono kind of invention of pro bono in a way, his work on behalf of all of those who were being exploited by the system, by large corporations, even by the government. Did he ever cite Jewish ideals behind those motivations?
No, frankly, it was not. He was more likely to cite, you know, until the end, until he turned to Zionism later, in which case, you know, he certainly educated himself on that. I think that for him, again, because his uncle, he idolized his uncle, and because his uncle was Jewish, he absorbed much of that into him. And, you know, his mother used to bring food to the Union soldiers when he was a child in Louisville, Kentucky, which was kind of mixed between the Union, the two armies.
The Union and the Confederate. Yeah, it was stuck in Kentucky.
Right. But, you know, his family brought food to the Union soldiers. I mentioned his book. His father often would say, any fool knows, that was his kind of catchphrase, that all people should be treated equally, regardless of their race, regardless of their religion. This was drilled into him as a young child by his parents, and it was something that he internalized. I can't say that he, you know, through most of his legal career, he did not say, well, he was stepping up or honoring Jewish history, Jewish custom, Jewish rights. To him, this was very much a human rights issue.
At one point, Brandeis, I think for a long time before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, became known as the people's lawyer. Did you ever consider that for a title for the book?
Yes, well, there were a few things. I mean, he was definitely called the people's lawyer. It was not a title, but I think there are biographies of Brandeis with that title.
Got to be careful about these things. I understand.
I was very lucky that his grandson's widow really was wonderful to me in the writing of this book and is very happy with it. I got advice from most of the, you know, many of the major Brandeis scholars over the years. If I had a question, I was able to turn to Jonathan Sonnen, Melvin Yurovsky, David Dowlin, you know. So for me, reading about Brandeis and trying to digest all his knowledge and his ideas for myself helped me try to pass that on in a way that it's understandable for children and for, in fact, many people. You know, I'm finding adults are buying this book and telling me how much they've learned about him. And that's for me that it seems to have both younger people and older people interested is wonderful for me.
I want to thank Richard Michelson for a great book and a great visit here on Too Jewish, but a great book as well. It's called What Louis Brandeis Knows, Crusader for Social Justice Becomes a Supreme Court Justice. Tell us where people can go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book.
Well, thank you. I mean, certainly everyone is welcome. Come to my website. It's richardmichelson.com. That's Richard, M-I-C-H-E-L-S-O-N.com. You can read more about the book. You can read about my many books. You can order a signed dedication if you wanted to give it for someone from my site. But also, it's available. It should be available at your local bookstore. Stop in and ask. Certainly, all the online bookstores are carrying it. I've been fortunate, and the reviews have been good, and getting to do a lot of speaking about the book. So please check it out. If you're listening to this, it'll teach you about, you know, it's history, but it's also, I hope, for everyone, I hope it's an enjoyable read.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Absolute pleasure, as always, speaking with you. I appreciate it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohat. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Corey Rosen, master storyteller, author of the new book, A Story for Everything, Mastering the Art of Storytelling for Every Occasion. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning is another version of Ahava Rabbah from the morning liturgy, this one composed by Ben Ellerin. My friends, may you enjoy a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray profoundly, of peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona. Adonai Eloheinu Chemlo.